This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic.
Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
The world is fascinated with cults. How they start, who runs them, who joins them, and how they get out. There are docos, podcasts, books written about cults from all angles. But what does it feel like to grow up in a world like this, so controlled? And how does it feel leaving, knowing that you'll likely never see your loved ones again? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, our chat with Beck, who has a story to tell.
People would be like, oh, this is my friend Beck. She's the one I was telling you about, grew up in a cult. And all of a sudden I'd be at a party and have like six eager faces staring at me wanting to talk about my childhood trauma.
Yeah, Beck's story is coming up very soon. It's our long listen of the week. First though, we're going to get into a story that's been making headlines around the world.
This is Hack.
Don't try to scam us because ACCC will get you.
On Triple J.
So many people do not watch traditional television anymore, and maybe you're one of them. You joined the online streaming boom when it came through over a decade ago. It also came with a lot of benefits. More choices meant that you got to watch what you wanted, when you wanted, and no ads. But slowly, as streaming has grown and grown, that has changed, and it's angered a lot of people. Well, now the Australian Consumer Watchdog is doing something about it. It's taking a global giant, Amazon Prime, to court. And a lot of people are watching this case closely. Ariana Lucente explains.
So I just fired up Prime to watch The Boys, and I get hit with a notification that from now on, unless I pay an extra $2.99 a month, they're going to be giving you limited ads.
If you've been watching some of the biggest shows this year, I'm talking The Boys, Off Campus, Euphoria, House of the Dragon, you might have been streaming through an Amazon Prime video account. So what do you make of all those ad interruptions?
And they're 2 minutes long. 2 minutes.
I just need to watch Vampire Diaries. I'd have to go through like 57 ads.
To every brand paying for a slot for marketing or an ad on Amazon Prime, tell them not to put your shit on in between my show.
Streaming services were ad-free for a while, but in the last few years, the ads have crept into the viewing experience.
We're basically back to cable television anyway.
Sure, it might be annoying, but is it fair?
We allege that Amazon introduced unfair contract terms in its subscriptions with Australian consumers.
The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC, is suing Amazon for alleged unfair contract terms on its Prime streaming service, introduced between late 2023 and August 2025, which basically paved the way for ads on the platform. Gina Cass-Gottlieb is the ACCC chair.
Annual subscribers paid an annual fee and signed up for a service that was ad-free. What we allege were those unfair contract terms. Amazon changed the terms, introduced ads, and made negative changes to the subscribers' services without offering any refund or remedy.
The ACCC plans to bring Amazon Australia and its parent company, Amazon US, to Australia's federal court. It's saying that the unfair contract terms mostly affected people who paid an annual subscription, potentially more than a million people, because when ads were introduced in July 2024, subscribers had to pay an extra $2.99 a month to stay ad-free.
It's really good to see this strong action from our consumer law regulator.
Erin Turner is from the Consumer Policy Research Centre. She reckons this case could send a pretty strong message to streaming services for film and TV.
Every subscription service should take note. You shouldn't be changing terms without engagement with your consumers and in ways that's unfair.
Amazon Australia has released a statement saying,
"We have cooperated with the ACCC throughout its investigation and remain focused on providing the best experience for our Australian customers."
So how likely is it that the ACCC will win?
The ACCC does seem to be using its enforcement powers to go after really big businesses.
Jeannie Patterson is a law professor at the University of Melbourne. She says in a lot of contracts, including your subscription with Amazon Prime Video, you can often find something called a unilateral variation clause, meaning
the supplier can change either the price or the terms of delivery or even the product themselves in their own discretion without getting permission from you.
She says this case could be legally tricky Because ACCC guidance says a fair contract should allow consumers to terminate without a penalty if that change does happen. But the idea of a penalty isn't clear.
Penalty has quite a technical meaning in law, and it's not the same as get their money back or get pro rata money back. So on a really technical interpretation, Amazon has done what the ACCC suggests, and it's only a suggestion.
If Amazon takes a settlement or maybe loses in court, it's a pretty big fine. I'm talking $50 million or more for both Amazon Australia and the US. And it could have knock-on effects in global markets too.
It's interesting because if the ACCC is successful in this case, potentially regulators overseas also can take these kinds of actions. So there's sort of a global movement in consumer protection now.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente reporting there, and a few comments coming through. Someone saying, why am I paying for subscription services with ads? Another person though saying, I personally don't mind ads as long as it's for shows and stuff that's in the platform. I pay a premium so I don't have to watch ads, and I don't want to see any of the sports betting ads come up every time I watch a show either. Yeah, we'll keep across that story. It's a big one. But it's time for our long listen of the week. And a heads up, we are going to talk about some pretty heavy topics in this one: coercive control, cults, abuse, self-harm.
Hack.
Inside the Geelong Revival Centre, where the pastor's authority reached into every corner of life.
On Triple J.
Growing up, Bec Condello never imagined getting old. And that's because she was part of a strict Pentecostal doomsday church that constantly warned that the world could end at any time. Beck says it was a cult, and so do a lot of other people who've left this church. She faced the anxiety of being told daily that she could be damned if she didn't follow the rules. But Beck got out, and then she had to figure out who she really was without her family. Like, imagine leaving the only people that you've ever known behind, knowing that you're probably not going to see them ever again. Well, Beck has written a book about her story. It's called Can You Handle a Girl Like Me? And it's out this month. I'm really happy to say she's with us in studio to talk about it. Beck Condello, welcome to Hack.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me.
It's a very interesting story. Can you talk to us a bit about your childhood, Beck? And, you know, your family grew up in this Geelong Revival Centre. What was that?
Yeah, so I was born into it. My parents joined in their early 20s. My mum was only 19. It was very sort of closed off to the outside world. So anyone, even if you told me you were Christian, you were going to burn in hell because you weren't coming to our very specific church. And I just grew up with this mortal fear of God returning to the earth at any point. And if I hadn't prayed properly this morning, I might burn in hell for all of eternity. And I was just always so scared of just God seeing and knowing everything. And the pastors of the church were direct conduits to God.
Did you know much about the outside world?
Not really. I mean, I think especially for me in my family, there were certain things that were expected of the cult. But then for whatever reason, my parents just had this additional layer of control. And so I didn't grow up having a TV. I was homeschooled until I was 10. So my world was tiny. I mean, my parents had told me from such a young age, if I sinned, if I questioned anything, I was going to get kicked out of the church. And I didn't know, as a kid, that's a very real threat.
What was your relationship like with your parents?
It wasn't great. One major aspect of the belief system in the cult was that children were to be hit to punish them, to keep them in line, and they backed that up with scripture. The more you hit a child, essentially, the more you were kind of guaranteeing their place in heaven. Again, my parents were especially strict, and my mum was very controlling, and I grew up very afraid of my parents. I talk in my book about how my dad used to go around and shut all the windows in the house so that the neighbours wouldn't hear me screaming when he hit me. And I remember thinking, like, it always wondered me that the neighbours never heard, but then I was like, but my mum was also in the other room, and I'm not a mum now, but I can't imagine being a mum and hearing your children being hit and not having some kind of like emotional response to that. And not only that, she'd been the one primarily that was telling my dad to hit me.
What were the rules like?
So I had to pray twice a day, half an hour in the morning, half an hour at night. And especially as a girl growing up in the cult, it really was expected that I would just eventually become a young wife and mother. And so it was everything we did was really just like a means to an end, essentially. And, you know, I never imagined that I would get old. Like, I always just thought God was going to return any minute.
Did you ever imagine that you would be outside of this situation? Like, you said at 10 you started to question things. How did that progress?
I think I never fully really felt like I 100% believed it. But I also just didn't have any evidence that it wasn't right. So I don't know that there was like one specific point, especially in my childhood, where I was like actively questioning, because I didn't even really know what to question. Yeah. I knew I didn't love it, but I don't think I had the understanding to have that thought process of like, is this right or wrong? And that wasn't until I got a little bit older into my late teens that I really started to question. I was just so painfully lonely. Like everyone I'd ever gone to Sunday school with had all left. I wasn't allowed to have friends outside of the cult.
How much power did the pastors have?
They had ultimate power. I mean, they could have said anything and people would have just blindly followed it, and they did. To the point that when I ultimately did leave the cult when I was 27, my mum never spoke to me ever again and probably never will. I remember when I met my now ex-husband, I was taken aside and basically told, like, you have to marry him.
Can you tell me about how you met what became your husband?
I was kind of ready to leave. I'd decided that my parents were never going to just let me leave. So I decided to write a letter and make up a lie that I'd slept with someone. And I thought, like, if I tell them I've had sex with someone, I'm going to get kicked out of the cult for at least 2 years. That was the expulsion, you know, for sinning. And my parents can't argue with that. So I'd written my parents a letter. But I'd already booked tickets to go to another state for one or the other. We had like multiple church camps scattered across the country. So I'd already booked my ticket. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to go. And then when I come back, I'm going to give my parents a letter and then I'm going to leave. Unfortunately, there, that's where I met my ex. And he seemed kind of cool. Like, he seemed a little different. He seemed kind of funny, a bit out there. He seemed just a little outside the square. And I remember thinking, okay, maybe I actually don't have to leave. And so then, yeah, not long after that, we'd started dating. He had to like ask his dad and his pastor and my dad and my pastor first before anyone could even ask me what I wanted. And we hung out for like 7 weekends before we got married.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Bec Condello, who's author of a new book about her life, her experience leaving, as she describes it, the cult that raised her. Bec, so you've met this guy, you've decided to get married to him. Were you excited at that point?
I guess there was some excitement because I was excited to be getting away from my parents. But it wasn't like, yeah, I'm like super excited because I've met the love of my life.
So you didn't want to get married, really?
I knew that that's what I didn't want. And I remember when I got married, I felt this sort of almost sadness in me where I was like, you know, I remember when I picked up my wedding dress and I kind of just hung it up in my bedroom until my wedding day, and I never looked at it until the day of my wedding because I just, yeah, I wasn't excited about it.
And the wedding night itself, was that like a scary experience?
Yeah, so we had never had sex or any kind of real intimacy. I think we'd like kissed quickly on the lips or something, but we'd had no time. Like, we weren't allowed to be in the same house together before we were married. So everything was very moderated. Yeah, our wedding night came. I had some anxiety because I remember when I was a young teenager, I'd tried to use a tampon and I couldn't use a tampon. So I remember I had this anxiety that, like, I just felt like I wasn't going to be able to have sex. I mean, additional to that, I mean, I didn't really know anything about sex.
Yeah.
When my mum gave me the sex talk, it was like this book that had been handed around the cult, and someone had taken a Sharpie and blacked out all the penises in the book so that girls didn't see what a penis looked like. So I was just so monumentally unprepared for sex. But I felt this pressure that was like, okay, it's our wedding night. We have to sleep together. And I tried to have sex and it just felt so painfully impossible. I thought, yep, I'm the problem. You know, initially I think my ex was kind of understanding about it and, you know, supportive. And ultimately we were two also young people that really didn't know what we were doing. We were also kind of relative strangers to each other. We went and stayed at his parents' house for the first few months of our marriage, which is not conducive to intimacy. So, yeah, we just did not get off to a great start, and we ultimately were not able to have sex for the entirety of our marriage.
And how long were you married?
10 years.
10 years.
It wasn't until I finally left him at 32 that I went to a therapist and I went to a gynecologist, found out that I had vaginismus, which is not uncommon with a lot of women. But for me, for the entirety of my 20s, I thought I was the only woman in the entire world that had this thing, because we didn't have access to medical or mental health support.
What was your marriage like?
It's what you'd expect to marry someone that you just don't know. And I'm always really careful the way I talk about this because I don't want to say that, you know, my ex was entirely at fault or whatever. I just think we never should have gotten married. I think we were two entirely different human beings that were fundamentally misaligned. You know, like if I went on a few dates with him now, I'd be like, oh no, absolutely
yeah.
not.
Yeah.
You know, in a perfect world, I would have actually gotten to know him and then been like, oh no, he's not my type at all. He just had a very controlling personality. Everything I did just irritated him. I genuinely just don't think we liked each other as people. I did what I was supposed to do as a wife, cooked and I cleaned and I did all the things. And I just over the years just became more and more hollowed out and empty and lost.
You're on Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm joined by Bec Condello, who's telling us about her life growing up in a strict church that she says was a cult. She's got a book coming out. It's called Can You Handle a Girl Like Me? Got a lot of messages through on the text line, someone saying, I was in a sister cult and I completely relate to so much of Bec's story. What courage to speak out. Another person saying, look, this is a compelling reason for compulsory public sex education focused on bodily autonomy. Bec, how did you get to the point of deciding that you wanted to leave the Geelong Revival Centre?
This is probably one of the worst times of my life, actually. So maybe around 26, my ex had been, he was a tradie and he'd been doing some work for pastor of a church outside of our church. Through that, my ex started to question things in the cult. So initially he comes home and he's like, I've got all these questions. I freak out because I'm like, I don't want to go to hell. Like, let's not question it. Even though I wasn't happy, I was like, I don't want to question it. But then over that year, that was actually one of the weird things that kind of bonded us for a minute, like where we kind of came together and we started really questioning things. He then took his questions to the pastor and his parents, and their response to him was just, you need to pray about it. You know, you need to pray about it. God will reveal it to you in the Bible. And because we'd had all these issues with intimacy, I had told him at some point, I had a couple of experiences when I was a kid that I felt like I'd been abused, sexually abused as a kid. But because I didn't have a lot of the language for a lot of the things I was experiencing, a lot of those memories are kind of foggy and a bit hazy. And, you know, as an adult with my adult brain, I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure something happened there, you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't have enough to like clearly say, yes, this is what happened. And so I think I'd told him about those experiences as like, maybe this is why I can't have sex, you know? And he had kind of taken that and just, I think that made him feel better because then he was like, oh yes, it was definitely those things and not our miserable marriage.
Yeah.
He basically said to me, I want to take what happened to you as a kid to the pastors and kind of use that as evidence that the church is flawed. And I was like, absolutely not. I just didn't want to talk about it. And he just kept on like pushing me about telling them. And I was like, no, I don't want to do it. One day we're having a conversation and he was like, you know, he just had an argument with his parents about the cult and I think he'd been talking to the pastor. And I turned to him and I'm like, stop trying to keep everyone happy. Just do what's right. In my head, I think I'm saying, let's just tell them we're going to get the hell out of there and let's just leave. He looks at me really strangely and he's like, okay. And he leaves. And he comes back 15 minutes later and he's like, you're not going to like what I did, but I did the right thing. I'm like, what did you do? And he's like, I told them what happened to you as a kid. I had a full meltdown. The ground just like opened up underneath me. I felt so exposed, so betrayed, so upset. Anyway, so then the cult did their little inverted commas investigation. No one talked to me, by the way. No one ever once picked up the phone. No pastor ever came over. My ex was like, well, they think you're lying. And he's like, actually, you know what? I think maybe you might be too.
And so how were you feeling?
It was devastating. Like it was so devastating. But I remember in that moment, although it was so traumatic, there was also this moment in me where I kind of called bullshit on the whole thing because I'd been told my entire life that these pastors heard directly from God and God knew everything. But I know I'm telling the truth. God knows everything. They hear from God. Something's broken here. And so in that one moment, all the doubt that I'd ever had, like, oh, if I leave, I might be wrong, or like, what if this? I was like, oh, no, actually, this is all wrong because I know I'm telling the truth. So I just was like, okay, I'm not going back. No one ever spoke to me ever again. I had not just lost everyone I'd ever known in a second. I'd lost my whole value system and my whole identity and my whole sense of belonging, where I belonged in the world. I had no idea what was going on. I had no idea what was next. I had nobody to turn to.
So from that moment Did you speak to your husband?
Not really. Like, every time he came home from his parents' house or church or whatever, he would just be so angry at me.
Did you have any conversations with your family?
No.
That was it?
Yeah. I wrote my mum a letter a couple of months later and I explained to her what had happened, and I'm fairly sure she either wouldn't have read the letter or she would have just handed it straight to one of the pastors. She wouldn't have wanted to put her own soul at risk by, you know, by that point, they'd kind of basically labelled me a harlot. Was told that I could never come back, which, I mean, yay, but.
Do you remember the last conversation you had with your parents?
So my dad is actually out of the cult now.
Okay.
I don't have any relationship with him, nothing with my mum at all. And I think it's sad for multiple reasons. I think she's missing out not just on my life, but she's also missing out on her life. I don't think she will ever leave, so which means I will never speak to her ever again. And, yeah, her mum actually passed away at the start of COVID, and as far as I know, she has no idea that her mum's passed away.
Have you connected with some of that extended family that your parents had cut off when they entered?
I did, kind of relatively early on when I first left the cult. It was really nice for a little while. It was kind of through my grandma. Initially, I wrote her a letter. I knew where they lived and I'd written her a letter, and then my grandma died at the start of COVID, and then sort of gradually over that time, I just kind of got excluded from family events and things.
Sorry, Beck, that's hard.
Yeah.
That's hard.
I got really depressed. I got really down for a while. I got pretty suicidal. And then one day I realized that I wanted to give myself the chance to see if the life that I had kind of maybe imagined for myself might exist out there. But I didn't even know where to start. And so by that point I was working. Then my ex ultimately ended up leaving the church. And so then we stayed together for 5 years after that.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Beck Condello, author of a new book about her experience leaving a strict doomsday church that she was born into. Hearing from you on the text line, Sarah in Melbourne saying, I also grew up in the Geelong revivalist cult. I was lucky enough to leave when I was about 10, but many of my family members were there most of their lives. It definitely does destroy families, Sarah says. Beck, you're at this situation now where you've left the church and your husband later gets out too, and you're both living together, trying to figure out life on the outside. How was that?
For me, I was just like growing and changing and evolving. I wanted to go live my life. I was like, I want to maybe go get a tattoo. I want to go try some drugs. I want to go, you know, I just wanted to go live my life. I was like, okay, like where else could we live? Like we don't actually have to live in the place that we've always lived. He just had no interest or desire in doing any of that. So as time went on, we just became more and more misaligned with each other. I got to the point where I felt like I was strong enough in myself. I'd built enough of a life for myself. I had good community around me. Yeah, I finally left him. I went and moved out, stayed with a friend. A month later, I was in Morocco. I was like, I just want to go somewhere so far away and so different to anything I've ever known. Maybe there was some expectation that I would have a terrible time from my ex, you know, and I'd come crawling back and be like, oh my God, I messed up. Please take me back. And I went and I had the best time. I just got back to Australia 3 weeks ago.
How many countries have you been to in the past 12 months, Beth?
23.
Wow.
Yeah. So I feel like I've more exceeded and made up for lost time.
Oh, I
feel
so.
Like I could start to slow down a little bit now.
I've overachieved. How much stuff did you do, Beck? Did you do a lot?
Yeah. I've done all the things. I think I've ticked boxes I didn't even know were there.
I wanted to ask you about maybe your relationship with your faith.
I don't know, and I don't know that I care right now. And I don't mean that in a dismissive way. You know, if someone can prove to me that God really does exist, I'm happy for someone to prove that to me. I just don't have evidence either way. And I'm not arrogant enough that I have to know, that I have to be like, yes, God definitely exists. I don't know. I haven't seen him.
So just checking the cross you're wearing, that's one of the fashion choices.
I realize that. I'm like, this is not what I should be wearing to talk about a cult.
No, you can wear whatever you want. You can wear whatever you want. But I'm like, is that a fashion choice or is that a belief choice?
No.
It sounds like you've had some incredible experiences, but I imagine there have been times where it's been lonely as well.
You know, I remember I used to be at parties and people would be like, oh, this is my friend Beck. She's the one I was telling you about, grew up in a cult. And all of a sudden I'd be at a party and have like six eager faces staring at me wanting to talk about my childhood trauma.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of the time I haven't, you know, if my whole family had passed away in a car accident, I think I would have a very different response from people. But people really enjoy cults and they enjoy hearing about cults. And so I think people, and then because of how I present now, I think sometimes people struggle to bring those two things together of like someone who's very healed and has this incredible life, but also has a lot of trauma in my past.
Yeah. And I mean, to be clear, and people can hear you right now, but in person, like you're just such a warm, vivacious, like beautiful person.
I think that's the thing that frustrates me, that I've lost time. And I think for a lot of people, they can't get past the time that's been robbed from them, and they hold a lot of anger and resentment and sadness for everything that's been taken from them. So I think it really took me like intensively years of having to like reprogram my brain. Mm. Even now still, I have responses to things that I know is like my childhood trauma, you know, like even with my book coming out, my brain automatically goes to all the things that could go wrong. I'm really struggling to just enjoy this whole process. And it's really cool. Like I'm on Triple J. Like, you know, like this is something I used to listen to Hack when I was in the cold.
Wow, really?
Yeah, on the way home from work. And, you know, so this is such a weird full circle moment for me where I'm just like, wow, like.
Can I just say that's a really crazy thing to hear? Like, was it a good experience listening to Hack?
No, it was great. I think I had like little moments of just like the outside world, you know, and I think this was definitely probably one of those components of being like, okay, like I know there's other things out there. Mm. And I was actually thinking about it this morning. I was like, huh, I wonder if I was allowed to listen to Hack or I just like listened to Hack. Like I remember I had a Hottest 100 CD and my mum saw it and she snapped it in half. Like she was so angry at me. I imagine if anyone had listened to Hack, it would have been bad. You know,
I am quite certain that that church would not have approved of Triple J Hack. What a crazy thing, Beck. I saw a piece that you wrote where you talked about the things that maybe you don't have that people might not think about, like pictures and photos.
I have a huge gap in my existence that I just have no memory for. I don't even think I can really clearly picture my parents in my head.
Like, really?
Yeah. I mean, you think about someone who maybe passed away like 10, 15 years ago. If you didn't have a photo, it's really hard for you to really put a clear representation of them in your head. Ultimately is why I wrote my book, because I got divorced. I woke up one morning and I suddenly realized I had no co-rememberers in my life. And then everyone I knew had only known me for a couple of years. And so I was like, oh, I need to write all this down. I need to pull all this out of my head.
I saw that you said Western culture loves to romanticize independence. We're taught to prize self-sufficiency, to see solitude as strength, to celebrate freedom without acknowledging what it often costs. But I think true strength lies in interdependence, in having people and places that tether you to meaning. When that is gone, freedom can start to feel like drift and mobility becomes motion without memory.
Mm. I think Australians, for all our like mateship and chillness, I think we have a very low effort like community culture. I think we're not very good at really intentionally and consistently like showing up for each other. And for as bad as the cult was, it was good at community. And I think it's taken me a really long time to find belonging in community, and I've had to be super intentional about it.
Beck, what's your life like now? Apart from the travels that you're doing, just the day-to-day?
My life is super curious and it's really free. And I think I got to create this life that isn't really bound by anyone else's expectations or idea. I didn't know what life was supposed to look like. So I just kind of kept in motion until I was like, yeah, I like who's looking back at me in the mirror and I like my life and I have all the things in it that make me happy. I really do feel like, honestly, like I know it sounds cliche, but I feel like the best is yet to come. Like I think you have so much freedom in life when you kind of just go, I'm going to be selfish for a minute and I'm going to do everything that I need to do to learn who I am, independent of a relationship, independent of a career. And I think that's the biggest gift you can give yourself. And I think it takes a lot of bravery, but I promise you it pays off in like dividends.
You're in a position now that a lot of people could only dream of. So thank you for chatting with us. It's been such a pleasure to get to know you. The book is called Can You Handle a Girl Like Me? It's immersive. It's beautifully written. Beck Condello, thank you very much for sharing with us on Hack.
Thanks so much, Dave.
And if you do want to listen to that full interview, it's up on the Hack podcast right now. We have long interviews going up every single Thursday morning, very early. You can catch it before work. Got a lot of messages coming through, someone saying, I grew up in the Geelong Revival Centre. Everything that Beck is saying is resonating. I'm so glad she escaped. She's amazing. And I am also that girl at the party too, Libby says, the girl who has to, you know, relive some of the trauma because people are so fascinated with the idea of cult. adults, what it's like. Another person saying, I left the exclusive Brethren and I have a better link now with God than I did back then, that person says. Another person saying, I'm Lenny and I'm part of what would be considered a strict religion. Everyone needs to look into the teachings of their religion and see if they actually align with the Bible and they're not just made up traditions. Yeah, Beck's book, Can You Handle a Girl Like Me, is going to be out later this month. And if that has raised anything for you, Lifeline is always there on 13 11 14.